Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. The New York Times called it something close to a nonfiction masterpiece. The award-winning, best-selling book creates an indelible portrait of America in crisis. George Packer, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Unwinding reads like a novel, but this isn't fiction. You introduce us to real, ordinary Americans struggling to make it. There's Tammy Thompson in Youngstown, Ohio, Dean Price in North Carolina, Jeff Connaughton, an idealist lobbyist working in Washington, D.C. And these stories are interwoven with profiles or short biographies of political, cultural, and business leaders. We're talking people like Sam Walton, Oprah Winfrey, Newt Gingrich. Why did you decide to tell this story the way you did?
There's a lot of books that are about what's happened in America during a certain period of time, and in this case, since the late 70s. But most of them are forgotten too quickly because they approach it as either conventional history or as policy and politics. And they have an idea or a group of ideas that you can be persuaded by or not, but in some way they don't hit home. And narrative is the form that I always write in and that I love, and I wanted to get deeper than just the big ideas and the obvious themes of that period into something closer to the way history felt and was lived and experienced by people. And to do that, I had to spend a lot of time with them and meet people who were willing to let me into their lives and then arrange it in a way that made sense. And that was the hard part, because we're talking about five or six stories that go from, in most cases, the late 70s to the present, but these people don't know each other, so I can't tie them together in an obvious way as a novel might, by having them meet. So instead, I turned to fiction as a model, and specifically to the trilogy USA by John Dos Passos, which is really an inner history of the first three decades of the 20th century, and done by the creation of fictional characters whose lives take you through the currents of that history, but also through the famous people, Henry Ford and Isadora Duncan and Frank Lloyd Wright. And so I thought that was an ideal way to combine the reporting I did, which was deep, immersive reporting in different parts of the country, like Tampa, Florida, North Carolina, Youngstown, Silicon Valley, Washington, and to create a bigger tableau, a bigger panorama than most journalism does, but to keep it intimate, to keep it focused on these people.
I love that you said that other approaches are forgotten too quickly, because a New York Times reviewer said, quote, "The Unwinding is a painful book to read. It made me feel ill as if I had contracted a three-day flu." And I have to say that it is so unsettling and powerful that describes exactly how it made me feel. So was compiling and assembling these stories and then sending them out into the world, was that in some ways cathartic for you?
It was surprising, really. And it was sort of liberating, too, because I was working in a way I'd never worked before, even though I've been writing journalism and nonfiction for many years. There are several things that were completely different this time. One, there's no first person in this book. There's no narrator who is explaining and interpreting and situating himself in the research. It's all done as if you know these people as characters in a novel. I don't go into the mechanics of how I met them and how I got certain stories from them. And that was liberating. And the second thing is it's in their voices to some extent. It's in the kind of indirect channeling of the language, the rhythms of speech, the images, the jokes, the odd use of words that people normally have. And so in that way, too, I got away from maybe a more sober and rational and conventional voice that applies in magazine journalism.
You say you're a reporter. Actually, you have a reputation as a triple threat. You're a reporter, an analyst, and a writer. And if there is any criticism at all of your book, it's that you aren't in it enough, that you don't provide enough analysis, or maybe that you don't provide solutions to America's unwinding. How do you respond to that?
You know, I don't think that was my job, and it was not possible in the terms set within this book. You can't both show a movie and talk about the movie that you're showing at the same time without really annoying the person who's watching it. And my intrusions would have seemed gratuitous and superfluous. I think if the reader doesn't have a sense of what is happening and why and how the stories are connected and how certain patterns are emerging and trends, partly through the experiences and the words, the thoughts of the characters, partly through the collages of newspaper headlines and songs and speeches and ads that I sprinkle throughout, then maybe the reader is looking for a different kind of book. But this book would have been sunk under the weight of analysis. It just wasn't open to that. And although I understand the criticism, that kind of reader is looking for a different kind of book. And I think I made the right choice.
You focus on three things as the causes of America's unwinding: the stagnation of the middle class and lowered wages, all of this sort of fueled by the emergence of Walmart. Then there's the Great Recession and the decline in morals and manners. But I want to focus a little bit on the stagnation of the middle class. You interweave these short biographies of political and cultural and business leaders, and one of them is Sam Walton. Tell me a little bit about why you included Sam Walton and how you got this short biography of him.
Well, all of the biographies of the celebrities, and there are, I think, 10 of them, are based on just research. I didn't interview any of these people. Sam Walton's been dead for over 20 years. And the reason I didn't was it just didn't seem worth the trouble. I don't think I would have gotten what I needed from them.
But you used their own words, which is to me really so powerful about it.
I used their accidental words, in a sense. I mean, in an interview, they know exactly what they want to say, and they say it, and they end up saying nothing because they're very practiced at it. But in their autobiographies, or in their songs, or in other sort of less on guard, autobiography is a great way to get to know how a person sees him or herself, because there's nowhere to hide, really. So Sam Walton has an autobiography. It's not a very good or interesting book, but it reveals a sort of folksy character who, just cared about ordinary folks and was building this retail empire because he, wanted to give people cheap prices. And it all sounds wonderful until you realize that at the same time, his chain was hollowing out businesses across the heartland of the country in all these small towns where one shop, pharmacy, department store after another had to close down because of Walmart. And you asked about the stagnation of the middle class. There's a sort of way in which the celebrities all do incredibly well. They are empire builders and brand builders, but they do it almost at the expense, in many cases, of the rest of the country. And there's a disconnect. They've been untethered.
In fact, you talk about Oprah Winfrey as being a shill for products that she would never use herself, and yet she's asking the American public, to buy into this.
Yeah, I think in her case, she's done many good things and has brought many important issues to her viewing public's attention. What I am troubled by is the way she peddles an idea of self-transformation and success through spiritual regeneration that I think is it's false, because most people's lives are hard because they're hard and because of circumstances, and not because these people just aren't as in tune with the universe as Oprah Winfrey, and she presents herself as a model for how to make it, and she has made it in a huge way, but I don't think it is a particularly useful model for most people. And there's a kind of magical thinking in her worldview, and it keeps cropping up in other stories in the book, because it's a really deeply American idea that if you want it enough and if you imagine it enough, you can do anything. It can be an inspiring idea, but it can also be a crushing idea, because as I say at the end of the Oprah chapter, it leaves you with no excuse.
If you think positively enough, success will be yours.
Yeah. Exactly. It goes back to what was called the mind cure of the late 19th, early 20th century. I think it's an idea that comes up at times like then and now, when there's vast inequalities, huge fortunes being made, and large numbers of people left out who don't think that the normal path upward is available to them, and so they look for a shortcut. In some cases, it's crime. In some cases, it's one big idea, and in some cases it's magical thinking and holding on to that philosophy.
You attribute a lot of the country's decline to the toxic politics invented and disseminated, really, by Newt Gingrich.
Well, he obviously isn't responsible for it all, but I think if you look around for a figure who created the political culture we live in today, Reagan is not the one, Clinton is not the one, even Nixon is not the one. It's Newt Gingrich. He came to Washington in the late 70s, right when the book begins, determined not to build up the institution of Congress, but to tear it down and rebuild it into a power base for himself and his ideas. And so he was really, in some ways, a radical, a figure out of the 60s, not so much a conservative. And the conservatism of this period of the last 30 years has been radical. And Gingrich, you know, I think for mainly cynical reasons, I don't think he's a true believer, has used it and got his way. He became Speaker of the House, tried to bring a revolution of sorts to politics and government. It didn't work very well because it was so destructive, but he got very, very far. And what he's left us with is a political culture where that language of total war and of demonizing the enemy and of being unwilling to cooperate, the polarization, that was his strategy. And it's now just entrenched. It's what goes on every day in Washington, especially on Capitol Hill.
Gingrich was basically banished from the Republican Party when Bill Clinton took office. But in 2013, CNN sort of revived his currency by making him one of the hosts of CNN's Crossfire program. And I'm wondering what you make of that.
Well, I think he's a great host for Crossfire. If that's your business, you want Newt Gingrich because he's a polemicist. He's very quick on his feet. He's very smart. He's good with words. And he digs in and lobs grenades and uses mustard gas. He doesn't hesitate to use the ultimate weapons. And that's what switching to a different institution, the media has more and more come to reflect and contribute to that kind of no prisoners, polarizing, toxic politics. It's what you see every night when you turn on cable news.
Speaking of news, I was a little surprised until I really read more about him. I expected, sort of profiling the media, you might have chosen someone like a Rush Limbaugh, but you chose Andrew Breitbart, who worked with Arianna Huffington in creating the Huffington Post, but then went a different direction, became much more conservative. How did you decide to choose him and not someone like a Rush Limbaugh, who certainly has had a huge influence?
You might say that Limbaugh would be too obvious a choice, and I was always looking for characters who didn't quite come to mind with the first thought of who from media, who from business, who from politics, who from entertainment. In Breitbart's case, he is younger than Limbaugh. He was hugely influenced by him, but he's a creature of the internet. And if anything has reshaped and really put in upheaval the world of media, it's the internet. The fact that he's a right-wing, or he was because he died a few years ago, a right-wing flamethrower is almost incidental. He could have gone to the left, and he did for a while when he was on the Huffington team, although he left just as Huffington Post was being created. But it's more that the purpose is publicity. It's to stir up trouble. It's to get clicks. It's to make himself into a national figure. So out of almost nothing, he has no ideas, no real background in politics or in government or business or anything. He's just a kid who had a modem and a facility for self-promotion. And from that, he created a little media empire and became, for a short while, kind of a notorious figure. And to me, that's the story of how the media landscape has been denuded and remade by both the partisan politics and the internet of the past 20 years.
If you are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker. His 2013 book, The Unwinding, was a New York Times bestseller and a National Book Award winner. Using stories of everyday Americans interwoven with short biographies of political, cultural, and business leaders, he paints a disturbing portrait of a nation in crisis. Well, speaking of the internet, you link the growing inequality over the past four decades to America's technical revolution. And there are some who would say that technology has given ordinary Americans a voice, that has been a democratizing force in America. Why do you say that the technological revolution actually made America less equal not more equal?
Well, both are true. I mean, Twitter gives everybody essentially a newspaper. And that's for those who want to be on Twitter, that's a great thing. It has created tremendous possibilities for ordinary people as well as for people in the profession. But has it created jobs? Has it raised incomes? Has it built institutions up that support the middle class? No. In fact, I think that the tech revolution has probably been, on balance, a job destroyer, as has globalization, or at least the jobs that have replaced the older industrial age jobs are not as good. There may be a little rise in manufacturing going on right now, but wages are lower than they were 20 years ago, which is an incredible thing, and that's part of the story of wage stagnation and the decay of the middle class. So I think it depends on whether you're besotted by devices and by culture, in which case the internet age and the social media age have been just dizzyingly fabulous, or whether you're looking at how people live, the concrete conditions of their lives, in which case you have to admit that things have gotten more desperate, and Google and Twitter and Facebook have not really done much to reverse that and may have done a bit to accelerate it.
The overarching emotion in your book is disappointment. There's disappointment in all of these famous icons that you talk about, with the exception, perhaps, of Elizabeth Warren. She's probably one of the only flattering profiles of a person in a position of power.
I would also add Raymond Carver, who is portrayed, the short story writer, who is almost from a different era, but anticipated some of the mood, the disappointment and disillusionment that we're talking about of this era. And he was simply a craftsman working hard to write as well and truthfully as he could. And I think that has to be saluted, along with the celebs who are doing other things. So that's why he's in there. But you're right, Elizabeth Warren is, I think, the one figure in public life who really doesn't mince words, who isn't afraid to make enemies of the powerful in both government and finance, and who's really both caught a wave and changed the language and the discourse about the middle class and banks. And for that reason, she's a throwback. She's like the old prairie populace, which is the title of her chapter, people like William Jennings Bryan and Robert La Follette, who were such stem-winding speakers in an era when there were far more politicians willing to take the common people's troubles as their issue.
I'm curious to ask you, because there are some who say she should run for president and that her window of opportunity is short and small. Would you like to see her run, and does a professed liberal stand a chance?
I don't think she could win, and honestly, I don't know that she would be a really good president, because there's a lot more to that job, as we've learned in the last few years, than to giving rousing speeches and having, you know, a clear idea. There's just so much that goes into management, into the business of using power. And I don't know if she can get people to cooperate with her. I don't know if she can, if she knows, you know, the various power centers in Washington and around the country well enough. I wouldn't mind seeing her run, simply because if she did, these issues would be front and center in the campaign. But I think she won't run if Hillary Clinton runs, because I don't think she wants to be the woman who goes up against Hillary Clinton and tries to derail her.
Getting back to this idea of disappointment, you do a marvelous job of telling Jeff Connaughton's story, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Connaughton's
story.
Yeah.
This is the political lobbyist who was a lifelong Biden guy. Biden is portrayed in this, basically, from Connaughton's appraisal, as this self-obsessed and ungrateful person who, you say in the book, is an equal opportunity disappointer.
It is. It's an unflattering picture of Biden, not as a public figure or a legislator or a vice president, but as a boss. And it's part of the story of Washington. You know, the Jeff Connaughton story is about what's happened to Washington in this period, because Connaughton's career begins in the 80s with Biden. He then becomes disillusioned, moves over to the Clinton White House briefly, and then becomes a lobbyist in the late 90s. And that's where his career takes off, because lobbying is where people in Washington make it and get rich, and he does. Then he has a turnaround after the financial crisis, when he has sort of a revelation about that and goes back into the Senate to try to pass tough Wall Street legislation. But it's a great arc of these decades because his career tracks so much with the revolving door culture of Washington. Biden is not in there to be picked on or singled out. I think it's more about Washington and how relationships become transactional and how the relationship between the boss and the aide, between the Hamlet and the Rosencrantz, is not a story you read very often. And I was lucky that Jeff Connaughton was courageous enough to tell me that story in just minute detail, because no one really wants to burn those bridges in Washington, but he was willing to do it. He had had it.
In fact, he left Washington.
Yeah, he's basically retired from government. He's not retired from public life. I think we'll hear more from him. And he wrote a memoir, and I think the issue of rogue finance and its capture of government will be a theme that, you know, that he cares about for a long time. But he was willing to tell me stories about how Vernon Jordan, you know, told Connaughton's boss, Jack Quinn, "I'm not going to call you, you call me. I'm the senior partner in this friendship."
Right.
And that's how, you know, Washington is this culture where everyone knows exactly what their status is in relation to everyone they meet. And that seems to concern most people more than whether good policies are being implemented in order to help the people.
You talk about this unraveling of unspoken agreements and these institutions, and you say that on one hand, what we've gotten are more personal freedom, but at what price?
I think, yes, two things have happened that almost cut against each other. We live in a period of unprecedented choices, individual liberties, you know, in our private lives, in our economic lives. We have more tolerance and inclusiveness for groups that used to be excluded. And so in some ways, you could say, what is wrong with you? This is a period of great equality. But if you get beyond whether Boy Scouts can be gay, you have to say we're a more hierarchical country. We're a more stratified country. The place where you're born determines the rest of your life more than ever. We have such unequal education. We have such grim job prospects for people without advanced educations. If you are without skills and without much education, you're really doomed in this economy. And if you have some skills that used to be rewarded, like blue-collar skills, working with your hands, and you still don't have much education, you're going to have a really hard time of it. So the haves and have-nots are farther apart than at any time in my lifetime. When I was growing up, more people with money nonetheless went to public schools. Public schools were more equal where I grew up in California. And there were jobs for the kids who didn't get straight A's. But it's a more unforgiving time now, partly because of globalization and technological change, and partly because of changes in our culture and in the way we behave. And so I have to say, on balance, it's a harsher America than the one I grew up in.
All of the people that you have featured in your book are all resilient Americans, from Tammy Thomas, who was from Youngstown, Ohio, to Dean Price in North Carolina, to Jeff Connaughton. Then you have Usha Patel, who's the only Indian person in your book. She's from Florida, and she ran a motel. Her story is interesting because her family, when she came upon hard times, her family, three continents away, helped support her.
Yeah, Usha Patel is the one immigrant in the book, and I wish I'd had more space to either tell her story at greater length or portray another immigrant, because I think that's where the future is, and that's where the energy is, so in many parts of the country. But she, you know, has her American dream of scraping together hard-earned money to buy a motel off the interstate outside Tampa, and then almost immediately hits the housing crisis, and suddenly she can't rent her hotel rooms, and she is facing foreclosure by the banks that lent her money. And she goes up against those banks and really fights them hard, to a draw, basically. She will not let them take back the motel. She thinks that they got her into this trouble by giving her these loans, you know, preposterous amounts of money, when the hotel really wasn't worth that much, or the motel. What's interesting about her is, yeah, that she draws on a network of family in India, in England, in the U.S., who all chip in, and no one else in the book has that kind of support. In fact, interestingly, so many people in the book live alone and don't have a nuclear family with them. and don't have anyone to fall back on.
You know, it reminds me of an interview I did with some of the Lost Boys of Sudan. So here they were before coming to the United States. They lived in refugee camps, but they lived as a bunch of boys together and they shared their problems. And one of the most difficult things for them when they came to the States was they did not have that connection. They were alone in an apartment with no one to share their aspirations with or their troubles.
Yeah, it's the flip side of our individualistic culture, which is so liberating for some people. You don't have to live with your parents when you grow up as you do elsewhere, and you can move all over the country, and people do, and there's a lot of rootlessness and atomization, but the flip side of that is this aloneness and this sense that you're really in it by yourself and you have to make it up as you go along. But I think the three main characters, Tammy, Dean, and Jeff, all three of them go through periods of great adversity, and all of them come back and remake themselves, sometimes in midlife, really, in their 40s.
Tammy goes from a factory worker to a community organizer inspired by Barack Obama.
And Dean Price goes from being the owner of fast food joints and gas stations to a biodiesel entrepreneur. And Jeff goes from being a lobbyist to being an activist against the big banks. So all of them, both morally and almost in sort of the raw animal spirits that you need to survive, keep coming back and keep a kind of optimism, which I think is an American trait. And to me, even though the big picture, the canvas is one of disappointment, once you focus in on the faces and the voices, which are really the heart of the story, I find them pretty inspiring.
So how do we stop the unwinding? And are you optimistic that we can do that?
I mean, I think there's a few good trends right now, such as an economy that seems to be rebounding and some state and local government measures like raising the minimum wage and campaign finance reform that are encouraging and that show that there's, you know, people haven't quit trying. There's still a restlessness and a desire to reform, a sense that something's wrong, which I found everywhere I went, a sense that something's deeply wrong. But at the levels of power, whether it's financial, technological, political power, even media, cultural power, I don't see too many signs for hope. I think these institutions are so entrenched in a short-term and self-centered thinking that I don't look for answers to Washington or to New York or to Silicon Valley. I think for me, the place to look are in all of these out-of-the-way places where people are trying to figure out how to solve problems in their own neighborhood, because that's where you have to begin.
Well, then let me ask you this one last question, because you say you modeled this book after John Dos Passos, who he tried to inspire people to protest and to look at their situation and do something about it. What ultimately do you hope will become of or happen as a result of your book, The Unwinding?
You know, it's already happened, and I can't tell you how grateful I am and how surprised I am, because this is an unusual book. The form is innovative. There's nothing quite like it in nonfiction. It's not what people are used to reading, but it had a real readership and continues to. What I think and hope that reflects is a desire not just to read good prose and to be absorbed in good narrative writing, but to understand the country and to face it, to look in the mirror. I wanted this book to be like a mirror held up to the country, that people would have to say either, yes, that looks like us, or it doesn't, or here are the reasons why, to start discussions, to raise questions without coming up with definitive answers. And that's happened already, so I'm just truly grateful for the way that readers have responded to The Unwinding.
And I'm grateful that you took time to talk with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His 2013 book, The Unwinding, was a National Book Award winner and a New York Times bestseller. To learn more, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.